From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Ted Koppel about the media and politics and criticisms that the mainstream media have become the liberal media. And we'll talk about a couple of Nightline's more controversial broadcasts. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the word entrepreneur is being used in the presidential campaign. And rock historian Ed Ward reviews Smile, the album Brian Wilson abandoned in 1966, which has finally been released. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI has opened an investigation to determine whether the Pentagon improperly awarded Halliburton Company no-bid contracts for work in Iraq. The investigation expands an earlier inquiry into whether Halliburton overcharged American troops for fuel in Iraq. NPR's Jackie Northam says the FBI wants to interview a self-proclaimed whistleblower.
The FBI is going to be, first of all, questioning a woman named Bunatine Greenhouse, and she's an Army contracting officer who last weekend went public with allegations that Halliburton, a subsidiary of Halliburton, KBR, had been unfairly or improperly rewarded with no-bid contracts for work in Iraq, and these contracts are worth billions of dollars. The other part of the investigation will be the collection of documents from actually several government offices, and that includes Army offices in Texas.
NPR's Jackie Northam. A Halliburton spokesman says the investigation is nothing more than election year politics because Vice President Dick Cheney formerly ran the company. President Bush and Senator John Kerry campaigned before big crowds today. NPR's Don Gagne is traveling with the Bush campaign.
President Bush campaigning in Saginaw, Michigan, Dayton, Ohio, Westlake, Ohio, and Yardley, Pennsylvania is taking John Kerry on the issue of leadership, drawing a contrast between himself and the actions he has taken in leading the war on terror and what he calls John Kerry's indecisiveness, his changing of positions for political gain on Iraq and on the war on terror. It's an issue that the Bush campaign thinks that the president has an edge, so it's something that they will be hammering away at as the campaign winds down to its final days now.
NPR's Don Gagne. Rock star Bruce Springsteen joined Senator John Kerry for a rally in Madison, Wisconsin today. NPR's Scott Horsley was there.
Bruce Springsteen was a big draw for John Kerry's campaign here in this liberal college community in Wisconsin, a battleground state. Local officials say there were some 80,000 people gathered in the streets and spilling out over the balconies outside the state capitol building here.
NPR's Scott Horsley in Madison, Wisconsin. Kerry criticized the president about hundreds of tons of high explosives missing from an Iraqi military site, saying it showed the administration planned badly for the invasion of Iraq. Iraqi rebels killed 11 Iraqi National Guardsmen today, posting a videotape of the killings on a website. The video showed rebels beheading one government soldier, then shooting the others in the head. A voice on the video called on Iraqi soldiers and police to leave their posts and stop supporting the U.S.-led force. In stocks, the Dow gained 2 points to close at 10,004. The Nasdaq was up 6 to 1975. This is NPR News. Armed men kidnapped 3 foreign UN workers today in Afghanistan. NPR's Ivan Watson in Kabul reports this kidnapping is unusual because it took place in broad daylight.
Kabul has a huge security presence of thousands of international peacekeepers, as well as a large security presence from the Afghan security forces. These attackers, they basically cut off a United Nations marked vehicle in broad daylight, snatched the 3 foreigners after beating the Afghan driver of the vehicle for some time, and then drove them away. They have escaped. No one knows their whereabouts. This comes as quite a surprise, though there have been security threats in the past. There was a suicide bombing just last week in the heart of Kabul that killed two people in addition to the bomber. Nobody has seen an attack of this type yet in the Afghan capital.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Kabul. Two of the kidnapped victims were identified as women, one from Kosovo and another with dual British and Irish citizenship. The third was a male diplomat from the Philippines. All were working for Afghanistan's UN-sponsored election agency. The French government has agreed to transport Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat to Paris for medical treatment. The 75-year-old leader has been ill for the past 2 weeks, and aides say he briefly lost consciousness last night. His doctors said today that Arafat's blood test showed a low platelet count, but that the cause of the problem wasn't known. Israel announced today that it's lifting all restrictions on Arafat's travel and will guarantee his safe return. This will be the first time in more than 2 years that Israel has permitted the Palestinian leader to leave his compound in the West Bank. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Next month, Ted Koppel will begin his 25th year anchoring a late-night news program. His programs first covered the Iranian hostage crisis and were titled America Held Hostage. That evolved into Nightline. Koppel has become one of America's best-known and most trusted journalists. We invited him to talk with us about politics and the media. The media itself seems to have become more controversial in its coverage of the presidential election and the war in Iraq. TV networks and newspapers that used to be described as the mainstream press, like CBS and the New York Times, have been redefined by some critics as the liberal media. The Nightline broadcast titled The Fallen, in which Koppel read the names of the Americans who had died in Iraq, was not carried by the Sinclair Broadcast Group's ABC affiliates. Sinclair issued a statement saying the program, quote, appears to be motivated by a political agenda designed to undermine the efforts of the United States in Iraq. We'll talk later about that edition of Nightline. I asked Koppel first to comment on the criticism that the mainstream media had become the liberal media.
There are some folks who are very efficient at setting the agenda. And by saying that, what they do is make a lot of people more sensitive to what they are either putting in their newspapers or saying on their radio programs or broadcasting on their television programs. And because they know that they're going to be accused of being too liberal, sometimes I think they even lean over a little bit in the other direction. I think conservatives in this country have done an absolutely brilliant job of making liberals feel ashamed of themselves. I was on the road with John Edwards last week and asked him, you know, flat out, are you a liberal? God, no. You know, I mean, he didn't want that label. And of course, He answered it by saying, I don't like labels of any kind. Look, they all use labels. How can you be a politician in this country today without using labels? But the idea of being identified as a liberal today is as distasteful to most politicians, and for that matter, to most media representatives, I suppose, as being identified as a conservative was 25 years ago. 25 years ago, you had George Will, you had William F. Buckley, and that was about it.
Well, do you think the charges that parts of the media are liberal is having a chilling effect on the media?
That's what I was just saying. Mm-hmm. Sure, I do think it's having a chilling effect. I think it's causing people to think twice about what they say. That's not bad. You know, we should all think twice about what we say, and three times and four times, if what we're talking about is the accuracy of what we're saying, the fairness of what we're saying. But, you know, these days, God help you if you have something that looks as though it might be a program that is critical of someone in this administration. You know full well that if you say something that is critical of someone in this administration, you're going to be labeled as being a liberal. To a certain extent, I would have expected it to go the other way. I mean, I find, and I've been doing this now for a very long time, that eventually, you know, each new administration comes into office with some of the afterglow of their electoral victory hanging on, and there is sort of a brief honeymoon period, And then they start deciding who their friends are and who their adversaries are. And I'm very proud to say that I have found myself in the adversarial camp of every administration that has come in over the past 25 years. That's my job. It's not my job to be nasty to them. It's not my job to be unfair to them. But it is my job to look at what they do critically.
Do you feel that you, as a journalist, have faced any consequences for programs that you have done that have been critical of the Bush administration?
Oh, sure. I mean, consequences, not in the sense of their having done anything nasty to me, consequences that are perfectly appropriate from their point of view and that I fully understand from my point of view. In other words, the president is not available as an interview subject. The vice president is not available as an interview subject. You know, the Secretary of State does it every once in a while because Colin Powell and I have been friends for many years, and I think he, you know, he's a loyal friend, and therefore he does it. And the same with Condi Rice. I've known her for many years, and she has done many interviews with me. But by and large, those are the consequences. If you're not perceived as a friend, then they're not going to give you, you know, what is perceived to be the reward of an interview. I never really looked at it as being a reward. I thought, you know, we offer an opportunity to be heard and seen. They offer an opportunity for me to get news for the viewers of Nightline. It's usually been, you know, one hand washes the other. But we live much more in a time now, Terry, of punishment and reward.
Let me ask you this, in terms of how some parts of the press that used to be called the mainstream press are now being labeled as the liberal press, again, some of the TV networks, some major newspapers. And there are times when, say, on a television program, on a television talk show, you'll see somebody from, say, one of the TV networks or a reporter with a newspaper balanced, you know, with somebody who is a representative of a conservative blog or a conservative magazine, someone who's clearly conservative in their reporting. And I know I'm not naming names here, but I'm wondering if you have...
Go ahead, Terry, name some names.
I'm wondering if you have observed that and if you think that... in other words, if you think that if you were on a panel, should you be balanced by somebody who's clearly conservative? Would you consider that to be fair?
I consider it to be sort of insulting, but
because
I try to be as down the middle as I possibly can be in my reporting and in the way we present programs on the air, and I don't consider myself to be a representative of or a tool of either candidate, for example. You know, now while we are in an election, but I also don't feel that if one side keeps turning me down for an interview and the other side accepts, that I should therefore punish the side that accepts by saying, gee whiz, I can't do that because I haven't gotten an interview with the president, therefore I shouldn't be allowed to interview John Kerry. I mean, that's silly.
Now, you did a show on the Swift boat controversy. Nightline sent a reporter to the village in which that fight took place. The reporter interviewed several Vietnamese people about what they saw and what they remembered. And then you did an interview with John O'Neill, who's the co-author of the book Unfit to Command. Do I have the title right? Unfit to Command, right?
I think so. Yeah. I don't have the book in front of me, but he sort of heads up a loose unit of former Swift boat or of Swift boat veterans who are clearly opposed to Senator Kerry for a variety of reasons. And I think we have to point out, Terry, that we focused only, and we sent a producer, not a correspondent. He was our producer who was based in Hong Kong. And he went in because we were able to find the exact location where the events of, I think it was January or February of 1969, took place, and for which young Lieutenant J.G. John Kerry won the Silver Star. And we thought that was a fair thing to do because, as I said to Mr. O'Neill, I don't see where any of these peasants or fishermen had a vested interest in saying anything in favor of John Kerry. That really wasn't the point. Indeed, if you listen carefully to what they said, John Kerry clearly was the enemy. He and his men came in, killed a lot of their friends and family members and neighbors. The Vietnamese troops who were with them burned down most of the houses in that village. We simply wanted to find out and delve into what they remembered of that day. It was the most important day of the war to them because they suffered more casualties that day and, as I say, had much of their village burned down. So I felt, if anything, they were going to be sort of biased against Kerry. But interestingly enough, the account they gave really matched the after-action report, and I'm not altogether clear who wrote it. I don't think Kerry signed it or initialed it, but whoever wrote that after-action report and whatever was in the citation for the Silver Star matched very closely the account that these peasants gave.
My guest is Ted Koppel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ted Koppel. When we left off, we were talking about a recent edition of Nightline in which a producer in Vietnam interviewed peasants in the hamlet where John Kerry's now famous Swift Boat fight took place. What the peasants said they witnessed upheld the essence of John Kerry's story. Following that report, Koppel interviewed John O'Neill, the co-author of Unfit for Command, which attacks John Kerry's Swift Boat story and his larger record in Vietnam. I asked Koppel to describe how O'Neill responded to what the peasants had to say.
Well, I mean, basically, he put it in terms of who are you going to believe, those lying commie blank, blank, blanks, or, you know, a bunch of Swift Boat veterans. You know, that's a bit of a loaded question there. I don't, you know, A, the Swift Boat veterans who were with Lieutenant Kerry on that occasion, who were on his Swift Boat, have all pretty much confirmed his account, and those who have raised questions about it were not with him. So, you know, we're not talking about, American eyewitnesses who had one version and Vietnamese eyewitnesses who had another. We're talking about Vietnamese eyewitnesses who seem pretty largely to have confirmed what the American eyewitnesses saw and recounted.
This was a kind of incredible moment in television. I want to play an excerpt of it. You know, John O'Neill, in response to your questions, keeps holding up three books, one of which was his own, and quoting passages that back up his story. Let's just hear a short excerpt of that.
This is John Kerry's own approved biography, Tour of Duty. On page 296 of that book, John Kerry says, "Boy, he's glad there was only a single person there and not more. What you've done is go into a closed society instead of interviewing direct witnesses."
Mr. O'Neill.
"And produced a story that isn't even the story in his biography,
Mr.
or that
O'Neill,
of the Boston Globe."
We have other pieces of evidence, including the after-action report and, of course, the citation for the Silver Star itself, which talks precisely about a superior enemy force. You're the one who raised questions about the superior enemy force. It appears from the recollections of the Vietnamese who were on hand at the time, they recall a superior enemy force, 12 soldiers from, forgive me, if you'll put the book
Ted,
down, we can't read it anyway, so
Ted,
all you're doing is sort
Boston
of reflecting white light back. Yes. So?
Ted, this is the biography by the hometown newspaper of John Kerry. It says there was a single Viet Cong teenager in a loincloth.
I heard you the first time. I said, how
did you get that information? And
yeah,
he said, "I got it because that's what everyone told me." It's the same information I got. In John Kerry's autobiography, the same information appears,
Mr. O'Neill,
except that they don't give the age.
You're being repetitive.
Really?
I am referring to what you wrote your book and asking you to respond to what you have just heard from a bunch of people who do not seem to have... Yeah, no, we got the title, Unfit for Command. You know, just do me a favor. Stop picking up books, and let's see if you and I can more or less look at one another and just get a few questions and answers back and forth. You wrote that there was only
Ryan.
One man, and in fact, you didn't describe Ryan. Him as a...
Well, Ted Koppel, as an interviewer watching this, I was just kind of fascinated by how you handled it, and even just by watching your face, which read to me to indicate a mix of frustration and almost amusement. And that was just what I was projecting watching you. So tell me what was going through your mind.
Well, as I told you before we started doing this interview, Terry, as I was driving home, as often is the case, I thought of what I should have said, which is, let me see if I can summarize the twin pillars of your argument, Mr. O'Neill. Books, good. Vietnamese peasants, bad. Because that was essentially all he kept saying, you know, that they are, people who live in a dictatorial society, which is absolutely true. But sometimes people, even in a dictatorial society, if they don't feel that the government is going to get angry at them for saying something, feel free to tell the truth. I said to him over and over again, I didn't understand what incentive those peasants might have for confirming an account that they probably had never heard. I mean, they didn't know what John Kerry's account was. All but one of them had never heard of John Kerry before. They didn't know that he was running for president.
How did you decide to cover the story this way? The Swift Boat story had been, you know, for weeks, it had been the main subject of discussion on so many cable and radio talk shows. How did you decide to cover it this way, by actually having a reporter go to that village?
Well, we were approached, Terry, by a freelance producer who speaks Vietnamese, is married to a Vietnamese woman, has been in and out of Vietnam many, many, many times over the past 15, 20 years. And he said, look, I can get, indeed I have access to Vietnamese government maps that will allow us to find precisely the location of this incident. And would you be interested if we could do that? And we said, if we can send our own producer and our own camera crew, the answer is yes. And he said, fine. And let me just say again, Terry, because I think this is what frustrated Mr. O'Neill as much as anything else. There are any number of other aspects to the Swift Boat veterans' criticism of John Kerry that we didn't and I say couldn't on that occasion address. Ours was a very, very narrow slice of the story. For example, do I have some sympathy for the guys who were in the Hanoi Hilton, who were prisoners of war, who say that they were played excerpts of John Kerry's testimony before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I can understand totally how those guys feel. I really can. I mean, if that is true, if they were played those excerpts and they heard John Kerry saying things that they had refused to say even under torture, I accept that they would be very angry, very frustrated. We didn't address that on this broadcast. This was a very narrow slice of a story, and we felt that it was important only because it happened to be a slice of the story where we felt we could bring to bear the voices and the testimony of people who had never been heard from before.
Now, I want to ask you about a broadcast that you did that was very controversial, and I'm not sure you ever expected it to be. It was when you read the names of the American soldiers who died in Iraq. And the Sinclair Broadcasting Group told all of its affiliates not to run that broadcast. Apparently, Sinclair interpreted the broadcast as an anti-war statement. Did you ever expect that broadcast would be seen as controversial?
Yes. I mean, I thought it would be seen as controversial, but we didn't do it to be controversial. We did it because we felt it was just the right thing to do at the time, and it was early enough in the year that we didn't feel it could or should or would become a part of the political campaign. But that we did it as a tribute. I deliberately did not want to do it on, Memorial Day, because then I felt it would just, You know, we do things like that on Memorial Day all the time. And they become sort of a part of that day, and they get mixed up with the picnics and the start of the summer season, and people don't pay much attention. And I just thought, Lord, when we have this many young men and women who have died, that at least to be aware. I confess to a personal frustration, and I felt that when President Clinton sent troops to Kosovo, and I have felt that when President Bush sent these troops to Iraq. I'm a World War II baby. I grew up in England during World War II, and I remember, although I was very young at the time, that there was sacrifice involved, not just by the people who were fighting the war, but by the people at home. There was rationing. We had to keep our lights out. There were blackouts. The homes were hit by bombs, and people had to, you know, spend their nights in underground shelters to avoid the bombing of London. And it just seems to me that these days the approach seems to be, we can fight a war, and you folks back home don't have to give up anything. Not only do we not have to raise taxes to support this war, we're going to give you a tax cut, even as we are at war. There is nothing that any of you has to do, save those of you who have family members or close friends in Iraq. But the rest of you can just go on with your lives as though nothing were happening. I think that's a bad way for a country to be at war. I think it needs to be a national commitment, and that involves a certain amount of national sacrifice. And I thought that by showing the faces and reading the names of the young men and women who had died, and as I said during the program, not only did I not or do I not oppose the war, I happen to believe that we are committed over there, and we need to carry it through to a proper conclusion. I'm not for pulling the troops out. You know, this was not a political statement on my part, but it was a statement that says, pay attention. You know, there are real young men and women, and some not so young men and women who are dying.
Ted Koppel is the anchor of Nightline. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Weird U.S., your travel guide to America's local legends and best-kept secrets, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. And by Harcourt, publishers of The Red Queen, the new novel by Margaret Drabble, author of The Seven Sisters and The Peppered Moth. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Ted Koppel. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how the word entrepreneur is being used in the presidential campaign. And Ed Ward reviews Smile, the album Brian Wilson abandoned in 1966, which has finally been released. On the warm breeze, the little bells tinkle like wind chimes. Close your eyes and lean back now. Listen to it. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ted Koppel. Next month, he'll celebrate his 25th anniversary anchoring a late-night news show on ABC TV. When we left off, we were talking about the edition of Nightline called The Fallen, in which Koppel read the names of all the Americans who had died in Iraq. The Sinclair Broadcast Group issued a statement saying the program, quote, appears to be motivated by a political agenda, unquote. Sinclair's ABC affiliates did not broadcast that edition of Nightline. The program concluded with these comments from Ted Koppel.
The reading tonight of those 721 names was neither intended to provoke opposition to the war, nor was it meant as an endorsement. Some of you doubt that. You are convinced that I am opposed to the war. I'm not. But that's beside the point. I am opposed to sustaining the illusion that war can be waged by the sacrifice of a few without burdening the rest of us in any way. I oppose the notion that to be at war is to forfeit the right to question, criticize, or debate our leaders' policies, or for that matter, the policies of those who would like to become our leaders. Nightline will continue to do all of those things in the weeks and months to come. But not tonight. That is not what this broadcast was about.
I told Ted Koppel that I was surprised to hear him give his opinion of the war in Iraq.
I rarely do that, Terry, as I think you know, as a longtime viewer of Nightline. I felt it was important here precisely because the Sinclair Group was trying to turn this into some kind of a partisan statement. And clearly, the only partisan statement that they would object to in this case was they thought it was a partisan statement in opposition to the war. And the only way I could think of in this case to at least put my, to at least give people the information they needed to make a or come to a reasonable conclusion themselves was to tell them, look, I'm not opposed to this war. That's not the point. I'm not putting these names and faces up there to stir up opposition to the war. I'm putting the names and faces up there so that people don't think that wars can be fought without cost.
You ended your comments at the conclusion of the show by saying, I oppose the notion that to be at war is to forfeit the right to question, criticize, or debate our leaders' policies, or for that matter, the policies of those who would like to become our leaders. Outside of the fact that Sinclair stations did not show that broadcast. Do you feel like you have forfeited the right or have been pressured to forfeit the right to question or criticize or debate our leaders' policies or those of people who would like to be our leaders?
No. Look, I think that there you have to be prepared to take a little bit of heat. I took some criticism. I took some heat for it. I'm perfectly prepared to do that. And it's totally legitimate that people should be allowed to email me whatever their opinions are or call or send letters, and they do. The Sinclair Group tried to get all of their ABC stations not to carry the program. I think, in point of fact, only seven did not. And in six out of those seven markets, we found other stations who were willing to carry the broadcast. So the impact of Sinclair's opposition was, I think, exactly the opposite of what he had hoped to achieve. A, it was seen by almost everyone who would have seen it anyway. And B, what he tried to do, or what the group tried to do, simply aroused much more curiosity about the program than it would otherwise have had. And while we've gotten a lot of attention for doing the program, it was a very, very simple and not terribly exciting program. I mean, think about it. All I did was read the names and the ages of the men and women who had died, and we showed a photograph. And basically, they were up for like two and a half seconds, and then the next photograph would come up. And I think if you watched the program for the first 3 or 4 minutes, you got the point. And I'm actually quite amazed that so many people stayed and watched the whole broadcast. I would have thought that most people would tune in and say, okay, I get it, that's it, I've seen it, now I'm going to go off and watch something else. We surely didn't do it because we thought it was going to get a big audience.
Do you have any regrets of saying that you did not oppose the war?
No.
About stating an opinion like that?
No. No, I didn't. I mean, I felt, I've probably even stated an opinion before on the broadcast. Over, you know, I guess I've done about 6,000 broadcasts now, and I'm sure at one point or another, an opinion was allowed to sneak in there. No, I don't have any regrets about that because I think if anybody, you know, wants to talk about why it is that I don't think that we can pull out of Iraq precipitously, I'd be happy to talk about it.
Is that what you meant when you said you don't oppose the war? Is that what you meant, that you don't think we should pull out now?
No, what I didn't support at the start was the timing of it. And indeed, we did a 1 hour or 90 minute, I forget which, town meeting at one of the local war colleges here. And the title of the program itself sort of indicates where I was coming from. And the question was, why now? I did oppose the timing of it, or at least raise questions about the timing of it. But, you know, once the war was begun, I certainly understand what I think, you know, lies behind the enormous importance of U.S. troops remaining over there. And I think, parenthetically, you will find that if Mr. Kerry does win next week, that he will take exactly the same point of view. He's not going to be pulling anybody out of there anytime soon.
You and John Stewart have been having a running dialogue. You've been on his show, he's been on your show, and you've discussed the media and what is fairness.
Right.
And are comics doing the job of truth-telling that reporters should be doing but are not? So that's the dialogue you've been having with each other. Did you see his appearance on CNN's Crossfire?
No, I didn't. I've heard about it. I wrote him an angry email telling him how disappointed I was that I thought I was his chosen adversary, and you know, and now he's gone and deserted me and taken on all these other guys.
He basically accused them of doing theater and not doing a serious discussion of the issues, and they said to him, "Well, look at you. I mean, you know, you ask softball questions to politicians," and he basically said, "Well, you know, I'm a comic. The show that precedes me is puppets making crank phone calls." So, do you take sides in that?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think anyone who's been watching closely, all of this began, and it just shows you how, you know, we do tend to have sort of a herd mentality. All of this began when I had John on Nightline at the Democratic Convention. And we were teasing each other back and forth, but we both do it with a deadpan delivery. You know, we don't necessarily signal the fact that we're joking with one another. We were teasing each other, and at the end of the interview, I said, "That's it, you're finished." And I still had a deadpan delivery. Someone, I forget whether it was on Slate or, you know, it was one of these internet magazines, came to the conclusion that Stewart and I hate each other, and just, you know, had this vicious argument and that I had cut him off rudely at the end of it. We really, I mean, John and I are friends. We email each other occasionally. We have frequent phone conversations. I mean, we're not, you know, we're not friends. I've never been to his house. He's never been to mine. But we get along very well, and we agree on far more than we disagree. My only point is, I do not believe that it is necessarily the best thing in the world if young people today are getting all their news, or even most of their news, from John or David Letterman or Jay Leno. Those guys are terrific at what they do, but they are to television what an editorial cartoonist is to the op-ed page of a newspaper. And you couldn't just run a newspaper with 10 op-ed cartoons on the front page and think that you were doing an appropriate job as a newspaper. And you can't run a television network just putting shows like The Letterman Show or the Daily Show on and think that you are covering news. They don't cover news. They're satirists. They make fun of the rest of us, who are a bunch of pompous idiots. And they do it very, very well. But they don't substitute, or at least they shouldn't substitute, for what the rest of us are supposed to be doing there.
You have an anniversary coming up, don't you?
We do. Nightline, it's really two anniversaries. There is a program that preceded Nightline that the older members of your audience will remember. It was called America Held Hostage. And that began actually 25 years ago on November 8th. The hostages were taken on November 4th, and ABC started doing a nightly update on the hostage crisis, on November 8th. Nightline was born on March 24th, 1980, so we'll be 25 years old next March.
It must be odd, you know, every time there's an anniversary of the American hostage crisis, it's also the anniversary of your show.
Exactly. Jimmy Carter once pointed out to me that the only people who really benefited from the hostage crisis were the Ayatollah Khomeini and me.
Well, Ted Koppel, I'm glad you're on the air. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure.
Ted Koppel is the anchor of Nightline. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on how the word entrepreneur is being used in the presidential campaign. This is Fresh Air. The word entrepreneur may have come from the French, but it's been cropping up lately in the Bush campaign. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg takes a look at some new uses for an old word.
A while ago, the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations published its list of the top 101 sayings of 2002. It included a remark that George W. Bush supposedly made to Tony Blair. The problem with the French is that they have no word for entrepreneur. After the list appeared, though, a spokesman for the prime minister denied that Bush ever said anything of the sort. I believe him. It sounds like exactly the sort of remark that the English would cook up to put in the mouth of an ignorant American. In fact, despite the right's current disdain for the French and those who speak their language, entrepreneur is one of President Bush's favorite words, and he pronounces it with all the sensuous pleasure that foodies give to mousseline de foie gras. Speaking in Virginia a few months ago, he said, "Entrepreneur, isn't that a lovely word? You know, entrepreneur, we want entrepreneurs." Entrepreneur first came into English as a name for a theatrical promoter. It originally meant just somebody who undertakes something, just like the Italian word impresario does. But it was soon being used to describe a person who promoted investments or business schemes, often with a slightly unsavory connotation. A 1951 article in the New York Times described the gangster Frank Costello as a slot machine entrepreneur. The word didn't really come into its own until the Reagan years. As it happens, that was when champions of the free market revived the word capitalism in place of the more genteel-sounding free enterprise. But the redemption of capitalism didn't extend to capitalist, which still connoted silk-hatted predators like J.P. Morgan. Entrepreneur seemed ready-made to fill that gap as a name for the risk-takers and business builders who were the new heroes of the market economy. An entrepreneur is basically the same thing as a capitalist, only played by Jeff Bridges instead of Lionel Barrymore. By the 1980s, entrepreneur was more than 10 times as common in newspaper articles as it had been in the 1950s. Business schools started offering courses in entrepreneurship, a word that was practically non-existent before then. And people retroactively awarded the label to men like Thomas Edison and Henry Ford, who were never called entrepreneurs in their lifetimes. But in recent years, free market enthusiasts have been spreading entrepreneur around in a new, more democratic way that would have had the French scratching their heads. On CNN recently, Commerce Secretary Don Evans complained to Wolf Blitzer that the Democrats have been citing unemployment figures that don't count all the Americans who are self-employed. According to Evans, Senator Kerry wants to ignore the some 10 million workers that are the entrepreneurs who are self-employed, like truck drivers, like painters, like childcare workers, like hairdressers, like auto mechanics. It's true that for most people, the word entrepreneur doesn't bring to mind the guy who does dump runs in his pickup truck or the manicurist who works out of her home. And Evans' description might strike you as just another milestone in the great American tradition of job title inflation. You have the picture of those 10 million entrepreneurs standing shoulder to shoulder with Walmart's 750,000 sales associates, or the customer service executives who answer the phone when you call Comcast to ask about your cable bill. But the new use of entrepreneur is part of a great leveling of the language of capitalism, which sweeps away the old distinctions between capital and labor, or at least the growing proportion of the labor force who are foregoing health coverage and a steady salary to make their own way in the world. Last week, you were merely an employee. Now you're doing the same job on a piecework basis as a paid-up citizen of the ownership society. True, some economists have pointed out that the self-employment rate always goes up when the economy heads south. They've coined the term involuntary entrepreneurship to describe the upsurge. But a lot of people prefer to think of the increase as a healthy flowering of entrepreneurial spirit after a two-decade decline. A report from the Kauffman Foundation applauds the sharp rise in self-employment among blacks and Hispanics as a sign that those groups have a higher rate of entrepreneurship than whites and Asians do. Entrepreneur is definitely a lot grander than old economy phrases like piecework or for hire. But new job titles have a way of losing their luster if they don't come with new carpeting in the bargain. Writers who are paid by the word don't usually think of themselves as the medieval knights errant that the phrase freelance originally brought to mind. For that matter, employee doesn't have the panache it did when the Victorians first borrowed it from French as a fancy name for clerk. So it's unlikely that all those peripatetic car detailers and daycare workers are suddenly going to see themselves as having the same economic interest as Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, even if they do all have entrepreneur on their business cards. After all, these days, entrepreneur doesn't mean much more than we'll undertake for food.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and the author of Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. In a couple of minutes, Ed Ward will review Smile, the album that Brian Wilson abandoned in 1966, which has finally been released. Most of the songs are composed by Wilson, with lyrics by Van Dyke Parks. But this song segues into a Johnny Mercer standard.
I'm in the great shape of the agriculture.
Music from Brian Wilson's Smile. We'll hear Ed Ward's review after a break. This is Fresh Air. Years is a long time to wait for an album, and one which has been the subject of legend and conjecture for so long can't possibly live up to expectations. Or can it? Former Beach Boy Brian Wilson released his album Smile this year after abandoning it in 1966. Ed Ward, who's been waiting for it ever since, takes a listen.
There's no question, Smile is the record of the year. Whether it's the best record of the year or not, I'll leave to those who get to hear a lot more new music than I do. But there's no doubt about the fact that one of the great lost albums of rock history has finally been released, and that, in large part, it's worthy of the hype and mystery surrounding it for all these years. A little background. In the summer of 1966, the Beach Boys released an album called Pet Sounds, which had been recorded sporadically between the previous November and April. It was radically different from any of their previous records, in that it featured magnificent orchestrations, elaborate arrangements, and far more personal lyrics than the group had ever recorded. In large part, this was due to their bass player, main songwriter, and arranger, Brian Wilson, having retired from the road the previous year. Increasingly solitary, he put a large part of Pet Sounds together in studios he rented, only involving the group for vocals. Several of them thought the new stuff was pretty weird, but they indulged Brian, although they realized there was no way they could do most of the songs in their live show. During the course of the Pet Sounds sessions, Brian recorded a track he called Good Vibrations, and his lyricist, Tony Asher, wrote some words. Brian set it aside. Meanwhile, although it sold less than any previous Beach Boys album, Pet Sounds was drawing some attention. Just as Brian had been inspired to create it by the Beatles' Rubber Soul, a whole album with all good stuff, he called it. Paul McCartney was said to be listening obsessively to Pet Sounds. The Beatles were hard at work on the album which would become Revolver, but this Beach Boys album made them realize the bar had been raised in pop music. McCartney bought copies and gave them to his friends. Brian now turned his attention to a new project. With all the confidence he'd acquired with Pet Sounds, he conceived of an album with interlocking lyrical and melodic threads. With a new lyricist, Van Dyke Parks, writing dense, elusive, enigmatic lyrics, he began to work on an album he called Smile. When the Beach Boys heard it, they were appalled. This was just too weird. However, out of loyalty, or just a lack of options, they did add vocals, first to the Good Vibrations track he'd recorded, and gradually to some of the others. But between the pressures of creating this work, the record company's wish for more commercial music, although Good Vibrations became one of the group's biggest selling singles, and, most legendarily, the fires that broke out near the studio while Brian was recording a track called Fire, the project, and Brian himself, collapsed. For years, he refused to discuss it, dismissing Smile as inappropriate music. But in recent years, Brian Wilson has been making a comeback, with great support from a band called the Wondermints. And, as his confidence mounted, word began to leak out. He was going to complete Smile. And now he has. In a way, it's not much of a revelation. As it turns out, most of the major pieces of it have leaked out on Beach Boys albums. Several of them, including Good Vibrations, were on Smiley Smile, the patchwork album that came out in the fall of 1967. Surf's Up, which Brian played on a Leonard Bernstein TV special, even became the title track of a not otherwise very good album in the early 70s. But what a difference it makes when they're all put together in their original sequence, not to mention re-recorded by a band that's not only sympathetic, but enthusiastic. And Van Dyke Parks' words suddenly don't sound so odd.
A diamond necklace plays upon hand in hand some drums along to a handsome man in between. A blind class aristocracy, back through the opera glass you see, the pit and the pendulum draw. Are you sleeping?
People have made fun of columnated ruins domino, whatever that means, but what does it matter when it's set to a melody like that? One of Brian's other great melodies was previously hidden under a strange vocal by his brother Carl, but here it's given free rein.
She belongs there, left with her liberty, never known as a non-believer. She laughs and stays in her one, one, one wonderful. She knew how to gather the forest when God reached softly and moved her body. One golden locket, quite young and loving her mother and father, farther down.
But playing excerpts doesn't give the full scale of the project its due. Smile would have given Sgt. Pepper a run for its money if it had come out on schedule and sounding roughly like this. In a way, it's good that enough time has passed that we can hear it with some perspective. Having to top or equal it would have been catastrophic for Brian Wilson in 1967, but today it just is what it is, a perfectly realized pop album brimming over with good vibrations.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Spectra Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Fevre Dream and Dying of the Light by George R.R. Martin, author of A Storm of Swords. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with former Marine Captain Josh Rushing about why he loves the Marines but left in frustration. Last year, he worked at CENTCOM, presenting the American military point of view on the war to the world press. He's featured in the documentary Control Room. Join us for the next Fresh Air.